Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today is energy journalist and filmmaker Robert Bryce, who's been writing about energy and energy politics for over three decades. He's the author of five books and written on Enron's collapse, the drilling boom due to fracking, the future of battery production, and a critique of 100% renewable energy policies. He'll be a guest at the University of Tulsa next week. More recently, he's focused his attention on electricity generation. In his new documentary feature, Juice, How Electricity Explains the World, he says, electricity doesn't guarantee wealth, but not having it almost always guarantees poverty. He refers to it as the defining issue of inequality between rich and poor in the world today. 1.2 billion people on Earth have no access to electricity. Another 2 billion have inadequate or intermittent electrical service. In the 21st century, most of those people will demand the same sort of electrical service that Americans and Europeans enjoy. What does that mean for pursuing reduced CO2 emissions or the stability of societies and governments? In the film, he travels to India, Lebanon, Ghana, Puerto Rico in the wake of Hurricane Maria, and Iceland to look at the differing ways people seek reliable electricity. Bryce will be in Tulsa next Friday, October 11th, at 6 o'clock at the Lorton Performance Center to talk about the world need for reliable electricity and the film. There'll be a screening afterwards. He is my guest today on Studio Tulsa. Robert Bryce, welcome back to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Rich.
You know, a central point made early and often in your new documentary, Juice, How Electricity Explains the World, is the relationship between wealth and poverty and the availability of electricity. How closely linked are the two?
Well, they're really inextricable. I mean, you go to any country around the world, and making the documentary, we went to India, Iceland, Lebanon, Puerto Rico, New York, Colorado. The people who have electricity, cheap, abundant, reliable electricity, are wealthy, and the ones that don't are poor, full stop. And the people who are poor or need more electricity, they will do whatever they have to do to get the electricity they need. So that was one of the main themes of the film, was to just really underscore the fact that electricity availability underlies all the key issues we care about today. Inequality, women's rights, climate change are all tied to the availability of electricity.
This is really interesting, watching your journey, because you've been an energy journalist for a long time. And as a Texan and Oklahoman, you've rightly focused on fossil fuels for a good part of your career. What's behind your new interest in electricity? Do you think that's going to be the fuel of the 21st century?
Well, it clearly is. Electricity is the world's most important and fastest growing form of energy. We're converting more and more primary energy, that is oil, gas, coal, wind, solar, into electricity, because this is the driver of the modern economy. You look at, and I have a book coming out in March that I wrote in tandem with making the documentary, but in the book I go much more into depth on how Amazon, Google, Facebook, Microsoft, Apple, they are all huge, huge electricity consumers. So the reality is that the 21st century of what I call the merger of bits, electrons, and cash, this is really underway. And so electricity and reliable, abundant electricity is the key for economies moving that want to embrace digital technologies and AI, robotics, all of those things.
You know, one of your subjects in the film described the development of the electrical grid as the most important technological innovation of the 21st century or 20th century. And when you think about it, you think of what life was like before we had reliable electricity in America or in any country and afterwards. And it is night and day. And it literally gets to the fact of how we lived our lives prior to electricity.
Right. And we lived most of our, you know, much of our lives in the dark. And one of the key points in the film and in my book, which, as I said, will be out in March, is called A Question of Power, is that there are roughly 3 billion people in the world today who use less electricity than my refrigerator. I've used a watt meter, calculated it. My refrigerator uses about 1,000 kilowatt hours per year. There are 3 billion people living in locations where electricity consumption is less than 1,000 kilowatt hours per year per capita. So this is the defining inequality of our time.
And of course, those 3 billion people, for most of those people, electricity is a sometimes thing or not a thing at all. And that will change in this century, won't it?
Well, let's hope so, because one of the points that I made in the film And it came to me when I was in India, and I'd interviewed a woman named Rehena Jamadar in a remote village in West Bengal. It was this, that darkness kills human potential. Electricity nourishes it. If we want to bring more people out of poverty and help millions or billions of people reach their full potential, they need electricity, and they're going to do whatever they have to do to get it. And this ties in with one of the other key challenges that we're facing is of course, climate change and electricity production. The electricity sector is the single biggest source of greenhouse gas emissions. So if we're going to be serious about climate change, we have to be laser focused on the electric sector and on how we reduce carbon emissions in that sector. And I'm also very clear on that renewables aren't going to do that. We need natural gas and nuclear.
And I think managing that conversion for those next 3 billion people who move to reliable electricity, how they get their electricity is going to be one of the big questions.
Absolutely. And I think of all the places we went, I mean, we had tremendous adventures and you know, remarkable interviews in all of these places. In the film, we have 40 interviews with people from 7 countries on 5 continents. Beirut, to me, was among the most interesting because I'd been wanting to visit Beirut my whole life. But what we found there was that the corruption in the society, which is endemic in Lebanon, and Lebanon is a failed state. It's controlled in part by the Iranians, in part by the Israelis. The Americans have an interest there, the French colonialists. I mean, it's truly a remarkable city. But what are they using there to produce electricity? They're using diesel fuel and fuel oil. And why is that? It's because the system is so corrupt that those are the only fuels that are workable in that corrupt environment. They can't use coal because the government doesn't have the money to build new power plants. So you have what's called the generator mafia. The grid is unreliable. So people who live in neighborhoods in Beirut, they subscribe to a local generator who runs relatively small-scale generators that run on diesel fuel and fuel oil, and they provide juice when the grid fails. And the grid in Beirut fails at least 3 hours a day.
There are also Turkish generator ships that you visited. You could see a Turkish generator ship right off the coast next to the coal-fired power plant in Lebanon. You know, and when Lebanon doesn't pay the bill, the ship moves offshore.
Exactly. And this is one of the things that, you know, was one of the biggest and most remarkable examples of this, you know, Lebanon's status as a failed state. You had a power ship that was providing about 200 megawatts of power to the Lebanese grid, burning fuel oil. And the reason that the Lebanese government was leasing this ship from the Turks was because their government is so corrupt, they can't get backing, can't get the lending bankers to provide them the capital to build more power plants. So they pay exorbitant rates to the Turks. And, you know, the average cost of electricity from the generator mafia in Lebanon is on the order of 25 cents a kilowatt hour, which is double what we pay here in the U.S.
That was the one thing I found really interesting, was that you had businesses in Lebanon that were paying both official utilities and then the generator mafia. They're paying exorbitant prices for reliable electricity.
Exactly. And this is, you know, goes back to my point. People will do what they have to do, and including paying very high prices to get reliable electricity. So it wasn't just businesses. It was, you know, everyday Lebanese. We landed at Rafik Hariri Airport, and we didn't even get to our hotel before we had the download from our driver, Hussein Mosel, talking about the generator mafia. And he pays 2 bills a month, one to the generator mafia in his neighborhood near the airport, and another to to EDL, Electricité du Liban, which is the grid operator. So this is common in Lebanon, that people pay 2 electric bills, one to the government-owned monopoly, the grid operator, and one to the local generator.
I thought one of the most salient points in the film was when you visited Puerto Rico some 7 months after Hurricane Maria, and you found that a version of this same deal exists now, or at least a year or two ago, in Puerto Rico.
Yeah, that's a good point, Rich. And the way I characterize this is that the electric grid shrinks to the point where it can maintain integrity. So in Lebanon, the city of Beirut, it doesn't have integrity. So the grid shrinks when you have a neighborhood grid, right, where the neighborhood generator mafia will take care of the people in a few square blocks or a given region of the city. In Puerto Rico, what we saw were individual homeowners who couldn't rely on the grid. There was no such thing as the neighborhood generator or generator mafia, so people bought their own generators and were running them for as many hours per day as they could afford because they needed electricity.
My guest today is Robert Bryce. He's an energy journalist and filmmaker. His film is titled Juice, How Electricity Explains the World, which you will show as a part of the Hewlings Lecture at the University of Tulsa, Friday, October 11th at 6 o'clock at the Lorton Performance Center. And he'll also be showing the film. As you mentioned earlier, your film took you to India, Lebanon, Ghana, Puerto Rico, and Iceland to look at different ways people are seeking reliable electricity. What struck you most profoundly from those travels? As you mentioned, people will find a way to get power. In India, it's basically throwing a hook over a power line and stealing electric power. Other people are making very innovative ways of microgrid in Lebanon, where they basically create their own grid using renewables and solar power. What struck you most profoundly?
I think that I come back to this point, which is that for electric supplies to work, to have a reliable electricity, the grid has to have integrity. The society has to have integrity. And I thought about this for a long time. I thought, well, it can't be corrupt or you can't have too much theft. But integrity, I think, is the right word in that the system can't leak too much, which means that the people who are using electricity can't steal it too much. I mean, a little theft is okay, but if there's a lot of theft, then the system fails, like in India. And the integrity has to apply to the people providing it, too, so that the grid operator doesn't steal too much from the people that are paying for the electricity. So the common theme that, and I think it still is very clear today in Lebanon, because Beirut continues to have these problems, if the system doesn't have integrity, the grid will shrink to the smallest it has to be to maintain integrity. And if that means you own your own little generator in your backyard, because that's the only way you can assure people won't steal from you and you can have reliable electricity, that's what you'll do.
Of course, that generator is going to be burning diesel fuel, some of our most unhealthy, unclean emissions.
Sure. And not only is it going to be, there's going to be noise pollution, there's going to be air pollution, and it's going to be incredibly expensive. But again, this is the nature. I mean, you saw this in Tulsa a few years back when that huge ice storm hit and some people were without power for, you know, a week or 2 weeks. What were they doing? They were buying their own small gen sets and running them on gasoline or diesel fuel because they, again, were doing what they had to do to get the electricity they demanded. So this is just the nature of our society today, is that we can't live without electricity. This is the fuel of modernity. And this is true everywhere, in Tulsa, in Austin, in Kolkata. I mean, this is the essential fuel of the 21st century.
Well, let's talk about how that works in conjunction with global efforts to lower CO2 emissions.
That's difficult, Rich. I mean, this is the real challenge, and it's one of the reasons why we ended up in the film, and I do so in the book as well, but end up talking about the need for nuclear energy, which unfortunately, in the U.S., we're shutting down our nuclear plants. But in my view, if we're serious about reducing CO2 emissions, we have to be serious about nuclear energy. And fundamentally, we're not. And we're not as serious about it here in the U.S. So that means that globally, you have countries doing what? Using more coal. And so the share of coal in the global electricity market has stayed constant for roughly 30 years at about 38% to 40%. And countries like India, China, South Korea, Japan is building coal-fired power plants. Why are they doing it? Because coal is cheap. The deposits are widespread, and it's abundant. And so they can produce reliable electricity with it. So we're going to have any hope, I think, in reducing CO2 emissions from the electric sector. We have to be serious about nuclear.
Let me ask you about another sort of inverse relationship. As the developed world, Western democracies, move away from coal towards natural gas or clean burning fuels or renewables. I know you're not bullish on renewables, but you know, we are making a big push on renewables. That makes coal cheaper. And ironically, it will make it more available for places that want to build up their electric grid, a reliable electric grid, using coal.
You make a great point. If demand slackens, then the price should fall, and therefore spur demand. This is one of the, you know, the iron laws of economics. Regarding renewables, I think it's clear we're going to have to use everything. I am a critic of the wind business, have been for a long time. I'm more bullish on solar because it has the options of being either used at small scale and relatively large scale. And we saw the deployment of solar in Lebanon, where you had Chinese-made solar panels capturing Lebanese sunlight, storing that electricity in lead-acid batteries that were designed in Bulgaria and manufactured in India. So, I mean, it was a perfect example of just how international this business is. So, but why was solar so attractive there? Because they were competing with diesel-fired generation sets. So, you know, it was economic. But the reality is that, as you said, the U.S. and many countries in Western Europe are rushing away from coal. But that's not true for all of these countries. Poland is building more coal-fired power plants. And why are they doing that? Because they don't want to rely on gas from the Russians. The Poles and the Russians have a long, bad history, and the Polish people are just not going to depend on Russia for their electricity.
One of the interesting parts of the documentary was you had a number of voices, and one that struck my ear particularly was Ben Hurd, who seemed to be very much thinking climate first in his comments. But as he was talking, it was like he was downplaying virtually every source of energy until we hear him talk about nuclear at the end. And so I was really struck by the idea that there are some people who are thinking climate and environment who have reshaped their thoughts regarding nuclear. Because, as you well know, anti-nuclear activists and environmentalists were sort of deeply entwined for a long time in the West. And now you're seeing a rethinking of that.
You are. And glad you noticed Ben Hurd's comments, because, I mean, he really does just jump out of the screen. I mean, he's just such a dynamic presence in the film. And he's an Aussie. And he just got his PhD, I think, in energy economics. But, I mean, really sharp, critical thinker, has been pushing for pro-nuclear policies in Australia. And you're right. He takes a very dim view of renewables, pointing out that, as he says, if we're trying to protect the natural environment, why would we cover it with, you know, miles and miles of solar panels and wind turbines? That's the thing we're trying to protect. We want dense fuels. And I think that that's an essential point, is that we're urbanizing. We are, more and more people are moving to cities. So how do you fuel dense cities? You need dense power sources. And nuclear is the ultimate in power density. We ended up at Indian Point, the nuclear plant in Buchanan, New York. It's about 45 miles north of Times Square. That one plant sits on 1 square kilometer and provides 25% of the electricity used in the city of New York. It was just amazing. I mean, just an incredible facility, and yet it's being shuttered because of political reasons, not because of any economics, but because of political reasons. If the state wanted to get behind it and support it, they could, but this is part of the political fashion of today, is to be anti-nuclear and claim we can run the world with renewables. We can't, and it's a fool's errand.
You use a graphic that describes that India Point puts out 2,000 megawatts on 1 kilometer of land. To get a wind farm that would put 2,000 megawatts, you'd be looking at 1,300 kilometers of wind farm. You don't
That's
even
right.
mention solar. What would be the solar conversion?
Well, I'll give you the rough numbers. So Indian Point produces about 16 terawatt hours of electricity per year. So that's what the production from Indian Point sits on 1 square kilometer. To produce that 16 terawatt hours with wind, yeah, you need 1,300 square kilometers. I mean, 1 to 1,300? I mean, this is just a staggering number. And why are now states in the east, on the East Coast, saying they want to put wind turbines offshore? Because they can't build them onshore, because there's so many of people that are opposing them. So to your question about solar, the progression in power density is roughly something like this. For nuclear power plants like Indian Point, the power density is roughly 1,000 watts per square meter. Solar is roughly 10 watts per square meter. Wind energy is roughly 1 watt per square meter. So those are in rough terms. And then biofuels like ethanol and all the other nonsense, they're measured in the tenths of a watt per square meter. So this has been one of the main focuses of my work, has been this laser focus on power density, because it's such an important and easy way to assess the scalability and land use of these different sources.
And this gets to another point here in the United States, where we're making some efficiencies in our electricity usage. We're developing new industries that use incredible amounts of power. You mentioned Google and the huge power needs for some of these huge data farmers. But another sort of farming that is using huge amounts of power, you went to Boulder, Colorado, and we're looking at marijuana growing, which is all done indoors with grow lights. They use tremendous amounts of fuel, of electricity.
Exactly, and it was one of the things that had caught my eye before we went to Colorado. But yeah, we interviewed a woman from Denver Environmental Health who said that in Denver alone, the cannabis industry's use of electricity was growing at more than 30% a year. Well, that means it's doubling every 2.5 years or so. So it's just a staggering quantity of electricity to, you know, produce weed, which is by itself is just a remarkable fact. But since then, I've been tracking and have Google News alerts that alert me to stories about the amount of electricity that's being stolen to produce weed. And that is a whole other story that is fascinating. But just that, you know, these black market growers, some of them are mobsters. The Chinese mob is very active in California for a while, buying or renting houses in residential neighborhoods and stealing electricity from the grid to boost their profits. But yeah, I mean, it's just the electricity can account for a third of the cost of growing cannabis. And so enterprising mobsters and you know, people working in the black market have apparently decided, you know, they can steal the electricity and helps boost the profits.
My guest today is Robert Bryce. He'll be giving the Hewlings Lecture Friday, October 11th at 6 o'clock at the Lorton Performance Center. And he'll be showing his film, Juice, How Electricity Explains the World. He's a energy journalist, a author of several books on energy, and a filmmaker as well. And he's my guest today on Studio Tulsa. I want to ask you about how we're set in the United States for future electric use. There's been a lot of talk about the grid. It's much in need of modernization. How well are we set here?
Well, the U.S. is incredibly blessed. We have a very diverse fuel source for electricity production. We're increasingly reliant on natural gas, of course, as coal is ramping down. As nuclear is being phased out across the country, many of those plants are being replaced by natural gas, which is good for drillers and people in the oil and gas sector in Oklahoma and Texas and elsewhere. But I worry that we may be becoming too dependent on a single fuel. So if you look at some of these periods where we've had extreme weather, extreme heat, extreme cold, demand on natural gas and natural gas deliverability has been remarkably high. So you've had price spikes and so on. But, you know, the idea that we're going to completely transform the grid and go to 100% renewables, which is, you know, being talked about by the promoters of the Green New Deal and a lot of politicians, particularly the Democratic presidential candidates. Again, this is a fool's errand. There's just simply no way for this to happen in anything like the near term and even over the long term. And the problems, of course, are scale and cost. And the scale is directly related to land use. For instance, here's a fact that people don't hear, but is in fact true. Just to replace U.S. electricity demand with wind energy would require covering a land area twice the size of the state of California. I mean, you can't even build wind turbines in California today because of the land use conflicts. So the idea that we're going to cover some massive, even one California, with wind turbines in this effort to try and get to an all-renewable future, again, this is a delusion, and yet it's incredibly popular.
But one of the things your film does point out is the ingenuity of people in finding energy and ingenuity in finding new ways to make energy more efficient, breakthroughs. Because I remember 10 or 15 years ago, people would say, you know, wind energy will never produce more than 5 or 10%. Well, there are times, I know just in this last year, we've seen times where wind power has produced half of the energy consumed in Texas for a short amount of time, or here in Oklahoma when the wind's blowing. Are you discounting maybe the ingenuity of technology and maybe making these technologies more efficient?
I don't think so. Okay. I don't think I'm discounting that at all. I think I'm taking a very clear-eyed look at basic physics and basic math. The problem with the wind energy business and with the solar business is for them to expand dramatically, they have to cover more land area with their projects. I've been tracking this now for more than 5 years. There are an increasing number of rural governments across the country, from Maine to California, who are saying, no, we don't want more wind projects. In fact, in the last 2 months or so, Sedgwick County, Kansas, where Wichita is located, banned commercial wind projects. Why? Because they're concerned about aviation in the county. You know, that Wichita has a big aviation sector. So, again, this is a conflict that's in part about politics and part about people wanting to protect their neighborhoods, but it's also fundamentally lies in basic physics, that the wind energy business, the solar sector, are fundamentally limited by the power density of the wind and the sun, and they can't overcome that without covering more land, and more land means more copper, more steel, more, you know, concrete, all of these inputs that you have to use to counteract that low power density.
Let me ask you one last question. If, even though there are new designs for nuclear reactors that theoretically burn nuclear waste at lower temperatures and new designs for reactors, there seems to be no sense that America is ready to embrace nuclear energy again. How do we combat CO2 emissions in this country or any developed country?
Well, it's going to be a long and difficult process. I'll make one quick other point about renewables before I go to nuclear. If you look at what is happening in Germany, which is frequently held up as the model for American energy policy, the wind energy business in Germany has effectively been shut down because of rising local opposition. So it, again, is indicative of how local these energy policies are and how the sprawl that inevitably comes with large-scale renewable deployment is problematic. But to your question about how does nuclear move forward, the nuclear sector just needs innovation and it needs political support. For the U.S., we need to stop shutting down nuclear power plants. We need to keep the ones that we have open. The problem is that there's very little political appetite for that. There's no congressional delegation that is geographically based that is pro-nuclear. And it's not like the coal industry where you can count on, coal state senators in Kentucky like Mitch McConnell or in Wyoming. And oil and gas, Texas, Oklahoma, that their congressional delegations are predisposed to promote the industry's agendas. There's nothing similar to that for the nuclear sector. So there's very little political support in on the Capitol Hill for the nuclear sector in the United States and for keeping the existing reactors open. So what has to happen, I think, is there has to be more political support, but also the industry has to innovate. We need smaller, faster, cheaper, better reactors that can be deployed at scale, that are deployable at scale, and by that I mean the gigawatt and terawatt scale, the billions and trillions of watts. And there are companies that are working on that, but it's going to take not just a couple of years, it's going to take decades to make that happen.
That doesn't sound very good on lowering CO2 emissions.
Well, there is no quick fix. I mean, that is just the fundamental truth. Energy transitions happen very slowly. Remember Jimmy Carter said, by the year 2000, everything's going to be solar. Well, yeah, that didn't happen in 2000. It still hasn't happened today because of the inertia of the systems that we have in place. We have 275 million motor vehicles in America. They essentially all run on refined oil products. Yeah, we have a few Teslas, a few electric cars, but it's only a few. So any transition in that sector will take decades, and the same is true for the electric sector and the broader energy and power systems that we rely on. Now, they will be transitioned only very slowly. We'll see electric vehicles, we'll see electric delivery vans, Amazon's doing that. But the reality is that oil-fired transportation, won the day when Edison was still alive. And we're still living with that same legacy today, and the internal combustion engine is not going away.
Well, we'll look forward to the Huling's lecture. Robert Bryce, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks a million, Rich.
Energy journalist, author, and filmmaker Robert Bryce speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. His documentary film, Juice, How Electricity Explains the World, will be shown as a part of his Huling Lecture Friday, October 11th at 6 o'clock at the University of Tulsa at the Lorton Performance Center. That lecture is free and open to the public. His sixth book, A Question of Power, Electricity and the Wealth of Nations, is due to be published next March. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.